Hi, everyone. Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know, a show dedicated to empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. I want to thank you for joining me today because these conversations that I have on a weekly basis with leading experts and authors and researchers and practitioners are so profound and really do make a difference in your life. And as always, I have another really important conversation happening today. Before we go there, I want to welcome anyone who may be listening for the very first time. I always like to welcome all of my listeners, and certainly encourage you to go to my website, which is drcherylselman.com, or my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, because I post all of these shows. So if you can't listen live, you certainly can either find them on my Facebook page, or they'll be sent to your inbox if you opt into my website. And of course, I have another show on PRN every Saturday at 11 a.m. called The Love Code, which is another wonderful show with inspiring spiritual focus. So it's allowing you to make a greater connection to your spirit and support your healing and awakening. And that is also going to be available to you on my Facebook page or when you opt in to my website. Everything gets sent to you, as well as other ongoing information that I send out. So hope you'll be joining me there and be part of my community. Okay, so I am actually here talking to you from Australia. I am in the Sunshine Coast, which is an hour north of Brisbane, a very beautiful part of Australia. And since being here, I have had the opportunity to connect with some really inspiring people. And one of them is my guest today, who happens to live in my neighborhood right here on the Sunshine Coast. So we're going to be talking today about how the use of your mobile devices, let's say, and other devices are changing your body. And my guest is Dr. David Chahar, and his research has created worldwide sensation, I would say. He's become a celebrity. He probably won't say that about himself, but the truth is he has become a worldwide celebrity on this issue. And let me just tell you a little bit about him before we have this really profound and important conversation. So Dr. David Chahar is a chiropractor living here in Australia. He received a PhD in clinical biomechanics. His research has attracted worldwide interest investigating the impact of the use of cell phones and structural changes in the body. Before I bring David on, I just want to share something that some statistics that I came across. Adults spend about 11 hours each day interacting with media, which includes 6 hours per day watching videos, 45 minutes on social media, and 3 hours and 48 minutes on digital media, which includes cell phones, computers, and tablets. Much of this time, your head may be held in such a way that puts an unnatural strain on your neck and upper body. And that's what we're going to be talking about, and that's what David Chahar has been researching with a published study that really has gained attention truly all over the world. And it's just so great that I have him right here in my neighborhood and on this conversation, on this podcast. So David, welcome to the show, and it's just great having you here today.
Thank you, Cheryl. Thanks for having me. And if you don't mind, I'd like to...
Go ahead.
I'd like to just make a little correction.
Please do.
It's very important to understand that there's so much research these days about the links between the use of mobile phone with mental and physical and other effects on our body. However, I want to emphasize that my studies are not necessarily linking the use of mobile phone itself. We are discussing the use of aberrant mechanical load on the insertion, which is probably the cause, according to our hypothesis, for the growth of unusually large and testified bone spurs at the back of the skulls of young adults. We suggested in our research that those could be attributed to the use of handheld devices because in the discussion area of our studies, I think it is appropriate to speculate as to what do you think is the reason for what you have found, and that's what we did there. And so we suggested that perhaps the use of handheld devices have something to do with it, but we could not draw direct links because we didn't do the study itself as to whether or not truly the use of phones is causing that. But it's enough to get outside of your home or outside of your office and have a look around and see what people are doing in any waiting room or at the bus station or anywhere else to see that, of course, the use of those devices is quite endemic, and also the postures that are being assumed while using those devices are not necessarily desirable.
So for people who don't know about your study, let's start at the
Okay, so the way I got interested in research is because while I've been in practice, I've been noticing that bone spurs or growths at the back of the skull are present at, in x-rays of young adult individuals. So not only young adult individuals, but it was very surprising to see the prevalence and the size of bone spurs growing at the back of the skull of young adult individuals. I've been in practice in 20 years, and I've started noticing those mostly in the second decade of being in practice. There were many other things that I've noticed that I made a list of things I want to study. And one time when a professor came here to my office from the nearby University of the Sunshine Coast, that professor suggested that I should perhaps engage in research and study a lot of the concepts that I have been developing and teaching here, teaching my clients here at my clinic. And when I met with Associate Professor Mark Sayers from the University of the Sunshine Coast, we sat in front of a list of things that we were going to study. And so we had to focus on one thing from my PhD, and we selected that very interesting phenomenon of large encephalopods growing at the back of the skulls of young adults. And in my first study, what we did is we looked at 218 individuals, where half of them, or about half of them, were university students who were completely asymptomatic. They were recruited by a different researcher for a different study altogether. And we have measured these two populations and compared the findings. Between the two populations, we were surprised to find that 41% of the tested population presented with large bone spurs at the back of the skulls. In fact, 41% of them had more than 10 millimeter growth at the back of the skull, while 10% of the population had more than 2 centimeters, which is almost an inch, growing at the back of the skull. So those are quite substantial sizes. This particular study, we published it in the Journal of Anatomy in 2016. And it might be worth mentioning that in the review of the literature that I have conducted particularly for that study, I have went all the way back reading a document that was put together by Paul Broca in 1875. And that particular document is a document about craniometry, where he evaluated many skulls. He was very frustrated with the terminology external occipital protuberance to describe the area where these bone growths that we reported on are occurring, because he normally did not see any development of any protuberances there. So that made it even more interesting to see the high prevalence of those growing in the population that we have studied. and the substantial size of those. Another thing that may be important to mention is that bone spurs in general, or enthesophytes, as we are referring to them in my study, they normally grow to a size of a few single millimeters. So if you had a 3 millimeter or 5 millimeter bone spur growing anywhere in your body, that would be considered as quite substantial. And in our studies, to make sure that we distinct these growths from any normal occurrence of a protuberance at the occipital bone at the back of the skull, we did not consider any of the findings as a large enthesophyte or as a finding that we would report on, unless if they were larger than 10 millimeters. So 10 millimeter formation at the attachment of a muscle into a bone, it is quite substantial by any standards, and it is not probably accidental.
So you know, it's a really unique study because there are many studies out there talking about the physiological effects from exposure to Wi-Fi devices and what's happening on a biochemical level and how it could be altering things. But this is not what your study is about. Your study is unique in that it's really looking at how our structure is changing because of the habits we are operating with now based on the use of all these devices. As I was saying, like 11 hours of working with devices a day, which is, you know, I'm of the era, David, where cell phones didn't exist, right? I remember when I saw my first cell phone, which was a huge, huge thing that someone was carrying around in a shopping center the first time I ever saw it. I distinctly remember that. But, you know, I'm of the generation we never had cell phones. They didn't exist. And now, in, you know, just several decades down the track, we're spending most of our time on these devices. They're becoming ubiquitous. In fact, we're becoming addicted to them. We use them all the time. So our body has found is that the use of working with these devices is a natural position for our body to be in. And therefore, there are changes that are happening within our structure as a result of the long amount of time we are in an unnatural position and the body is compensating for it. Do I have that right?
Yeah, so I think it's very simple to explain the adaptation process that is happening there. Many people understand what a callus is on the skin and how and why will a callus will be there. Normally, the presence of a callus on the skin is as a result of stress on the skin. So if you have if you put stress on the skin because you go to the gym or whatever you do with the labor and so forth, the skin becomes thick. It just thickens at the area where there is too much stress on the skin. Not before you already lose some skin, you know, at first, but the body adapts. The body senses that there is excessive stress in the specific location, and it starts adapting by making the skin in the specific area where there is stress on the skin thicker and more durable. In our case, basically what we're looking at is we're looking at a particular site where the trapezius muscle and ligamentum nuca attach to the skull. So if our head is resting on top of our bones properly, what ends up happening is that we're loading the weight of our head on the bones mostly. And we use the muscles at the back of our head and neck only for balance and movement purposes. However, if we shift our head forward, what ends up happening is that the head becomes suspended. And if it is suspended forward, what prevents it from falling forward, I guess, down onto our chest is the muscles at the back of our neck. And so those are some of them, the most prominent one, like the trapezius muscle, are attached to the skull, and they help supporting the weight of the skull. That's not their job. That's not what they're designed to do. So what ends up happening is because of the increased stress on those muscles and on the attachment of these muscles to the skull, that attachment site is adapting to the excessive stress. And the way it adapts to the excessive stress is by, first of all, becoming more broad to spread the load on a greater area of the skull, and also by allowing for bone metrics to sip from the bone side of the insertion or the attachment into the muscle, the tendon side of the insertion. So the insertion site becomes broader and bonier, and that's why we see enthesophytes or bone spurs at that area. And so I think it is an adaptive process to excessive aberrant mechanical load at the insertion. And that particular adaptation process will occur with the shifting of the weight of the head forward for a sustained period of time, regardless of why you're doing it. You could do it because you're holding a phone in your hand, but you could be doing other things where you're holding your head forward for a prolonged period of time, and that will achieve a similar result.
But, I mean, this is not a normal position for the head to be in, as you were saying, and, you know, what we're doing in our lifestyle based on how we've been using technology is forcing us to have that position long term. And I think it's really clearly understood when you talk about a callus. So the longer we do that, the more we grow this callus. Some people, you know, in the PR or maybe the sensational part of your research has been calling these protuberances horns. That gets people's attention.
Yeah.
But it's not, it's, you know, that's just kind of sensationalism. But what actually is happening, there are noticeable growths, extensions, right, that are occurring,
yes,
in areas of our skull that should not be there, or that are abnormal.
Yeah, and in the anatomical world, it's actually not unusual to give structures a name that is a descriptive name out of the, the animal's world, because, for example, the cochlea inside your ear, in the inner ear, it looks like a snail shell, you know, but it's not a snail shell. It looks like it. And therefore, if someone thinks that this particular bone growth reminds them of a horn, it can look like a horn, and that's fine to say that it looks like a horn. It's fine to say that it looks like a beak. It's fine to say that it looks like other things as well. And there is nothing wrong with saying that, so long as people don't confuse this with, thinking that this is actually something that has bone metrics, horn metrics in it, and that it is an actual horn. It's not an actual horn. It's just a bone expanding into the tendon, into the insertion of the tendon, into the particular site. So
continue.
Yeah, we were very surprised to see that these growths are so prevalent in the young adult population. And we thought, well, what does that mean for if we're going to zoom out? What are we going to see if we're going to zoom out? And instead of looking only at the young adult population, we're going to look at a population from 18 to 84 years old. What kind of a distribution are we going to find of those enthesophytes in the population when we have a bigger spectrum of age? And so that's exactly what we did. So theoretically, you would expect that any degenerative finding in any area of our body is going to be probably more common with the advancing in age population. And so that's not exactly what we found when we did that particular research that was published in a scientific report, Nature. In that study, we have noticed that when you look at the over 40-year-old population, they behaved in a pattern that is quite expected, where as they grow older, the encephalocyte size is larger and also more prevalent with individuals who are older than as they progress from 40 and, you know, in age. However, what was surprising is that the young adult population that we have measured had larger encephalocytes, and the encephalocytes were more prevalent with that population than in any other age group that we have considered in that study out of the 1,200 individuals that we have measured. So,
I mean, that's what's profound about your study. And just to define, when you talk about encephalocytes, those are that building up of that callus that's creating a bony-like protrusion in the back of the skull, just so people know what that term means.
So the terminology is interchangeable, yeah.
Right. So basically, it's the younger generation, because of their habits, it's not the, you know, you would have thought maybe the older population could show more of this. That didn't happen. It was actually in the younger population, and obviously it's connected to the choices they're making with their use of technology.
So we basically, again, yes, we were surprised to see that younger individuals are showing degenerative features that are more prevalent and worse than the elderly population. And one thing that we haven't studied but should be considered is that because the young adult population is growing bone faster than any other age group, and this is just a physiological process that is happening in young adults where they grow faster anyways, maybe that is a reason that is adding to the high prevalence and the size of those encephalocytes in the back of their skulls or anywhere else, because they are at a phase in their life where bone deposition is occurring more rapidly than in any other age group. Maybe that is why they are reacting to it differently to other age group, because other people in other age groups are also perhaps using technologies and so forth. So this is something to consider. Another thing to consider when it comes to encephalocyte or bone spur formation is that from a scientific perspective, their development is linked with the use over a prolonged period of time. They take a long time to grow. So when you look at a 16-year-old, for example, and you see a large encephalocyte that is about 30 millimeters, which is more than an inch, you wonder how did this encephalocyte get to that size with a 16-year-old individual? At what age did this encephalocyte start growing? So is it possible that this individual was holding again, if we're linking it into posture, and this is again a hypothesis, I have to emphasize, that poor posture may be causing that, then who knows, maybe they started with their undesirable posture patterns from a very early age, at 2 or 3 year old. And if you ask me, I mean, it's not unusual to see 2 or 3 year old in, kids and toddlers playing with devices and so forth for a prolonged period of time. It's not unusual these days.
No, it's not unusual at all. You know, when I started to investigate the dangers connected to use of Wi-Fi technology, which was about 15 years ago, teenagers didn't even have phones. It was too expensive to have a plan. And now the average age that a child gets a phone is about 9 or 10. So things have changed rapidly in just, a decade or so. So my next question to you, David, is what are the consequences of this structural change happening? This, the compensation of the body, which creates this extension, this bony-like protuberance. What's the consequence physiologically to people?
Yeah, so go back to a formation of a callus on the skin, and a formation of callus on the skin, if we agree that it is in response to stress on the skin, when you remove the stress, the callus will go away. With bone spurs, it doesn't really, the bone spur doesn't disappear just because you reduce the load. You could just hope that it's not going to grow any further. So for this particular location at the back of the skull, there really aren't, at least not that we know, any negative implications to it, because it's not a weight-bearing area. If you have the bone spur that was only 5 millimeters at the bottom of your foot, you would have known about it a long time ago, because it would hurt as you're standing. But because this is a not weight-bearing area, I mean, those individuals we have studied never complained about a pain in that area. But the implications of this study are in, we have many implications actually, but they are in, to consider, for example, limiting the growth of bone spurs elsewhere in the body, and why, and what is the role of mechanical load in the development of bone spurs in general. So for example, in a case series that we have published in Clinical Biomechanics that was also accompanied with an extensive review of the literature, we've looked at teenagers from the age of 14 to 16 who presented with bone spurs or entesophytes at the back of the skull, which measured 14 and a half millimeters up to 30 millimeters, so from about half an inch to over an inch. And what we did is we considered whether or not they had any genetic predisposition to having bone spur formation, or whether or not they had any particular systemic or localized inflammatory processes that may be associated with these entesophyte formation. So we did the genetic testing, we did blood work, we did MRI testing on this group of individuals, and we found all those tests to be negative. And however, we did find that with all of them, their posture was not ideal. It was far from being ideal. And the reason why they saw us to, or saw me to begin with, was because of postural problems that they have presented with. So we then concluded that because of the lack of other findings, it is very likely that entesophyte formation with these individuals is as a result of aberrant mechanical load, and not because of inflammatory processes or genetic predisposition.
So if you are having your head forward all the time in an unnatural position, because that's what's required when you're looking at your device, which you found is creating these changes going on in the body, it's an unnatural position. It's not how we were designed to stand. It's not proper posture and alignment. It seems to me, if that is happening with young adults, 14 to 16, if they continue, because they're not, I mean, the use of these technologies are only going to increase, so they're going to continue to have this behavior that's changing their proper structure, there's got to be concern for consequences down the track, you know, from a chiropractic point of view, what's going to happen from a structural point of view, with your lungs, your compression of your, you know what I mean? There's got to be consequences for this unnatural posture that we never evolved with.
I agree. And I think that it's important to follow up on this and do some longitudinal studies and see if those things are going to keep growing, and looking into other areas of the body to identify perhaps other musculoskeletal implications that these postures may be associated with, which we are actually in the process of doing right now. And there is no doubt that the sustained load on the musculature of the back of the neck and at the back of the skull is already having some implications about it, because we see now that the complaints of headaches and neck pain and stiffness are becoming more and more common with individuals who are complaining of musculoskeletal disorders. It used to be that the focus was on the lower back. So if you look back a decade or two or three ago, the focus of investigations with regards to musculoskeletal disorders was on the lower back and lower back pain. And most of the complaints that people came with were lower back complaints, where you can see now that more and more the complaints are shifting up to the upper back, to the neck, and headaches as well.
That's pretty scary, because I think there's something like 75% of the world's population are now working with phones and, you know, have phones and are on their phones. And I know I was looking at statistics just for Australia, and the Australian stats are saying that Australians, 9.5 hours a day, they're working either on computers or they're on their phones, 143 days out of the year. You know? And so I'm sure that's also true what's happening in other countries around the world. So we're talking about something that could potentially be changing people's bodies all over the world.
Well, what we also have to recognize is that the use of mobile technologies or handheld technologies and computers and being sedentary as a society, this is not going to change. This is not going to go away. We just have to figure out how can we keep using those, but using those in a way that is less harmful to us. So while other people should concern themselves, other researchers should concern themselves and study the implications of those technologies from, immobility and mental and social and so forth, my concern is biomechanical and structural purely. And so saying that, I think that it's important to bring to people's awareness what proper posture is and how to use the body better while they're using those technologies. Because as I said, those are not going to go away. We're going to keep using them. So keep using them, but use them properly, use them smartly in a way that they're not going to cause you harm.
Well, that's a big, tall order you're asking for there, isn't it? So what are some of your suggestions that you would recommend to my audience who either are on their devices and looking over all the time, or have children or grandchildren who are using them in the ways we've been defining? What are some of the things we can do, David? Give us some help.
Yes. Okay. So if we agree that shifting the head forward creates an increased load at the muscles, at the back of the neck and in between the shoulder blades and at the back of the skull, and if the shifting of the head forward is shifting the weight of the head from the bones to the muscles at the back of the head and neck and so forth, and perhaps this is the reason for these type of formations and for other problems that can develop, so perhaps what we should consider is shifting the weight of the head back to where it belongs, to be back on the bones. So that's not that easy to do sometimes, because a lot of people who are trying to concern themselves with postures, with their posture, are trying to achieve an improvement in their posture in ways that are a bit complicated. and they have to pay attention to their abdomen, to their pelvis, to their chest, to their shoulders, to the neck, and to their head in trying to achieve a better posture. And that's what makes it very difficult. My suggestion to everyone is to stick with something that is going to be very simple, that is going to work for them. And what works for me is when I lift my chest straight upwards. So if I lift my chest straight upwards, my head shifts back, I flatten my upper back, and my lower back shifts forward. So I'm basically attacking all areas of my spine in one go. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So just say that again so people can follow. Just do that. Just
right.
Say that one
more
time.
For example,
so they can follow it.
Yeah. Okay. So basically, if you just take your finger and put it on your chin and then take it all the way down until you hit the very top of your chest. So when you hit that bone at the very top of your chest, now that bone, go ahead and pull it straight up. If you pull it straight up, you'll see that your head shifts back and you flatten your upper back and your lower back comes forward. So basically, in one go, where you're just lifting that bone, it's called the manubrium, that bone at the top of the sternum. If you're just lifting that bone straight upwards, you're going to achieve a better posture throughout your spine without having to pay attention to various regions of the spine independently. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah.
So in just doing that, you're shifting the weight of the head back onto the bones. And therefore, you're unloading the muscles. You're unloading the muscles from having to be employed with the sustained bearing of the weight of the head while the weight of the head is being forward. Does that make sense? So now the weight of the head is shifting back to the bones, so these muscles can do what they're supposed to do, which keep the head balanced on the bones of the spine, and also support the movement of the head, but they don't have to actually carry the weight of the head while the weight of the head is forward all the time. So my recommendation is to make sure that you lift that chest upwards and that also you make sure that all your screens are at the level that is comfortable for you where you don't have to drop your head down. And if you have to look down, perhaps you can look down with your eyes and not with your whole head.
Well, so your research, we talked about this earlier before we started our podcast, has gotten worldwide attention. And, you know, I think you're even surprised to the degree that you have kind of rocked the system. Why do you think that all the media outlets, you said the Washington Post wants to do an interview, you've been on major websites, you've been interviewed on, you know, God knows how many programs. What's going on, David? Why do you think your study has generated such tremendous interest around the world?
Yeah, I think that there are a few reasons for it, and I think that some of the terminology that was used, such as horn growing at the back of the skull, you know, is quite increases people's curiosity. The fact that we're dealing here with, through the media, where basically many of the media outlets picked mobile phones are the as the key word for why those things are happening, even though we did not say that in our research. I think that it appealed to the wide population. So I think it's the terminology that was used. I think also that because these kind of things could be affecting the vast majority of the population, as again, because the word cell phone was used, and as you've mentioned, almost everyone is using cell phone these days, so it's affecting everybody. So I think this is another reason why it received that kind of attention. I think that the conversation as to what mobile technologies are doing to us from a social, physical, and mental perspective is a conversation that is that is anyways happening throughout the world, and that while, again, we did not bring any specific hardcore scientific data to link mobile phones, for example, with these anatomical adaptations, I'm quite happy that my study brought people's attention to aberrant postures and consequences those may have with the use of technologies anyways.
You know, because, I mean, what you found, and, you know, again, your population was young. Well, what was the average age, or what ages were you dealing with the subjects in your study?
Yeah, so the three studies that we did were dealing with different age groups, but I think that the main issue was directed towards the 18 to 30-year-old age group that we have studied, because we have compared those to other individuals of in different decades of their lives, in their 30s and 40s mm-hmm. and 50s and so on. And so I don't really remember the exact mean age of the population within the 18 to 84-year-old, but in terms of decades, we had about we had 300 individuals within the 18 to 30-year-old group, and similarly within the advancing in age population, and about 200 in the decades in between, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. Does that make sense?
Yes. So
I'm not sure that answers.
Well, I know that you were concerned because you saw this rapid growth in the younger subjects. So this is just the beginning of, first of all, this research, but it's also just the beginning of a person's life. So if they're already showing these signs of changes, and they're 18 or 20-year-olds or 25-year-olds, you know, the implications are pretty scary to think about what's going to happen as we, you know, progress in life, as we get older, continuing with these habits. We don't know. I mean, this is uncharted territory. This is, I mean, you know, we're all guinea pigs, and we're guinea pigs on many levels. There's, you know, the evidence of what has happened from exposure to pulsed radiation from all our technologies. But this is, we're looking at what's structurally changing, biomechanically changing in the body. And you just, you know, you were the first person to do this research to acknowledge this and to have it in a published study. This is, you know, you're the frontier, right? And, I mean, what do you see happening in the future if we don't make some changes and have awareness to the impacts on our body, on our physical structure?
I think that, you know, there is good news and bad news, as you might expect. The bad news, look, is that, yes, this is this issue is prevalent. These structural changes that we have reported on are quite substantial, and that those things, once they grow, the bone spurs, they don't go away. But the good news is that it's very simple to limit the growth of bone spurs and in general. And so basically, if aberrant mechanical load is causing it, perhaps we can improve how we are loading our bones and joints and skeletons. It is so simple for people to think about any mechanical structure that they have or own, whether it's their car or their bike or anything else. And they know that if they're going to take care of it and use it properly, it's going to wear and tear less. And if they're going to abuse it badly, it's going to wear and tear faster. So you have some people who have a 30-year-old car that looks like brand new, and you have people who have a 2-year-old car and it looks like it's been trashed. And so I look at our mechanical system, at the musculoskeletal system, in a very similar fashion. Either we take care of it and we are loading our bones and joints the right way, so things are going to, all the components are going to rub in a way against each other, in a way that they were designed to, or we're going to use it in a way that it is not designed to be used, and it's going to just wear and tear faster. The issue is to find a very simple solution and to implement that solution and to be consistent with it, and not to give yourself, not to give yourself a break, basically, and thinking that this is not going to happen. You know, it's to me, I draw analogy between maintaining oral hygiene and then maintaining musculoskeletal or postural hygiene, if you would like to call it that way, if you know what I mean. You know, if you forgot to brush your teeth one day, nothing is going to happen. If you didn't floss one day, nothing is going to happen. But if you, you know, if you don't do it throughout your life, wear and tear, degeneration and damage, all that is going to happen. And it's going to happen quietly. And one day it's going to be there. And with musculoskeletal degeneration, well, most of those, all of those individuals we have studied did not have symptoms. That means that their problems there developed quietly, silently. We didn't know that they're developing until we saw them on x-rays. So that means that, firstly, these degenerative findings can develop silently. We now know also that they can develop from a very young age because they're showing in young adults. Because large encephalopathies, according to the literature, are not supposed to be there until we are over the 40-year-old. And so now we have shown that even teenagers have those. So then we need to ask ourselves, okay, so what should we do? And I think that the answer is early education of proper posture from an early age, and keeping it reasonable and realistic, not asking individuals to do too much to maintain good posture, but also, you know, make them understand that they need to do something about it. I hope that makes sense.
You know, it makes sense. I mean, maybe one of your projects, David, would be to put a little video together that people can learn how to structure, you know, shift their structure or stretch in a certain way. It would seem as your research gets out there, as the implications of what you're finding gets out there, and assuming there'll be more people who are going to be investigating this, it opens up a whole new arena of what is required to counteract the impacts of this. So whether it's chiropractic adjustments, which I'm a big fan of because I've been using them for 50 years of my life, or whether it's yoga stretches or other stretching regimes, we've got to be incorporating it into schools, I would think, as an integral part of their program.
And yes, I suggest that. I support that. I think it's logical to think that the mechanical problem deserves a mechanical solution. And again, I think that a big emphasis for a successful implementation of a solution is going to have to be on the simplicity of the solution. So, for example, when we talked earlier about just lifting the chest bone upwards, to achieve changes throughout the whole spine. So that's one way of looking at it.
Well, this is eye-opening, and it's a, you know, what you've brought forth in your research is just making it very apparent how many changes are occurring in the human species as a result of this experiment, which I think it is, on humanity with all these technologies. And as I said, we're just talking about the structural components of using these technologies. There's just so much happening, and it's happening so rapidly, and it's happening so pervasively throughout the world, that we're seeing, you know, unprecedented changes happening to humans at this point in time.
It will be interesting to see, and I'm now talking not as a scientist or, you know, or just as a human being who is also using devices, who have children and a family, and also using them. And it's going to be very interesting to see how all that is going to be addressed within the next few decades, because again, as you've mentioned, it's the musculoskeletal part of it, in my perspective, is the simple one to deal with. It's very easy to deal with. I think that the other implications, the social, mental, and so forth, are going to be much more difficult to limit.
Well, before I go, do you have another area of research that you're planning? Are you doing more studies?
Well, we are in an advanced editing of a couple of other manuscripts that are dealing with damage in other areas of the spine, and I will be very happy to discuss those once they've been peer-reviewed and published. But until then, you know, it's probably better to just, you know, let them be.
Well, we'll just have to be patient and wait. But we'll definitely have you back, David, when those new areas of research are published, because I think your work is really profound. You've opened up, I would say, a Pandora's box of issues that we didn't really know even existed. And as you said, because it's silent, you know, silent at this point, this growth of this callus, you know, this kind of protuberance is a silent development at this point in time. But as we continue to use these devices and as it shows up in younger, you know, younger adults, we really don't know how the implications of how it's going to be affecting us down the track. So, you know, I certainly want to congratulate you on taking this line of research, and congratulations on the success you're getting in bringing this awareness into the world, which is definitely, I mean, it's definitely struck a note that's getting people very interested in what you're doing. So thank you for your commitment in this work you're doing, and thank you for your time today. It's just been so enlightening, and I really appreciate everything that you're doing.
And I appreciate you inviting me to have this discussion with you and to speak to your listeners as well. I really appreciate that. Thank you very much.
You're so welcome. And to all of you listening, well, there you go. Another facet of this journey we're on, certainly a journey we're on with the high-tech world we live in. I want to thank everyone for joining me today and for being part of this conversation. As always, it's a pleasure to be with you. I trust you'll be back next week. And until we meet again, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.